I never expected to become the poster child for near-death experiences. As a neurosurgeon trained at Duke and Harvard with 15 years of practice, I was the last person to believe consciousness could exist outside the brain. Yet, in 2008, I contracted an extremely rare case of bacterial meningitis that shut down my neocortex completely for 7 days. What happened during those 7 days transformed me from a skeptical scientist to someone with an urgent message about the nature of consciousness and reality. My book became a number one New York Times bestseller, translated into over 40 languages, resonating with millions worldwide. Oprah Winfrey called it one of the most compelling and provocative books she'd ever read. What makes my case unique isn't just the experience itself, but my medical credentials and the unprecedented nature of my illness, a spontaneous case of E. coli meningitis with a survival rate approaching zero, making it perhaps the most technically impeccable near-death experience ever documented. At 4:30 a.m. on November 10, 2008, I awoke with excruciating back pain in my Lynchburg, Virginia home. By mid-morning, I was experiencing grand mal seizures as my wife Holly called 911. At the hospital, doctors performed a lumbar puncture that revealed the unthinkable. My cerebrospinal fluid wasn't clear as it should be, but viscous and greenish-white, filled with pus. The diagnosis was bacterial meningitis caused by Escherichia coli, an extremely rare condition in adults without prior neurosurgery. Fewer than 1 in 10 million contracted spontaneously each year. The situation was dire. My cerebrospinal glucose level had plummeted to 1, normal as 80. My Glasgow coma scale was 8 out of 15, and my chances of survival were rapidly diminishing. Before losing consciousness completely, I shouted 3 words that everyone present heard clearly: "God help me." These would be my last words for 7 days. As a neurosurgeon, I understood exactly what was happening. Ancient E. coli bacteria were devouring the glucose in my cerebrospinal fluid and attacking my brain's cortex, the region responsible for everything that makes us human: memory, language, emotion, and logic. Without this outer layer functioning, consciousness as we understand it should be impossible. Yet what I experienced during those 7 days defies conventional medical explanation. Think about what makes this case so extraordinary from a scientific perspective. Most near-death experiences occur during cardiac arrest, when the brain still has residual activity. In my case, my neocortex, the part of the brain essential for consciousness, was completely offline, documented by multiple neurological exams and lab tests. The medical team had essentially given up hope, telling my family to prepare for my death or, at best, a persistent vegetative state. No one recovers from bacterial meningitis after a week in deep coma with a non-functioning cortex. Yet here I am, not only recovered, but transformed. My first awareness was of existing in what I later called the realm of the earthworm's eye view, a primitive, limited consciousness without memory or identity. Imagine being submerged in dark, murky mud, yet somehow able to see through it, like peering through viscous gelatin that extends infinitely in all directions. There was no language, no emotion, no logic, just a primordial awareness in a timeless void. The experience was neither pleasant nor unpleasant initially. It simply was, much like how an earthworm might perceive its environment without the complexity of higher thought. As this strange existence continued, I became aware of objects around me: root-like structures glowing a dirty reddish color, pulsing with an otherworldly bioluminescence. These weren't the clean, bright lights of operating rooms or the warm glow of sunlight. They were biological, organic, almost fungal in nature. The longer I stayed, the less comfortable I became. What initially felt like immersion began feeling like imprisonment, as if the mud itself had consciousness and was slowly becoming aware of my presence. Grotesque animal faces bubbled from the muck, not cartoon-like or human, but primitive creatures with ancient, unknowable features. They were accompanied by mechanical, pounding noises and terrifying chants that seemed to emanate from everywhere and nowhere simultaneously. The biological smell of death permeated everything. Not the antiseptic smell of hospitals, but the raw, earthy decay of organic matter. This experience parallels what neuroscientists might expect from primitive brainstem activity, basic awareness without higher cognitive functions. The brainstem, our most ancient neural structure, controls fundamental functions like breathing and heartbeat, operating below the level of conscious thought. If my journey had ended here, it might be explainable through conventional neuroscience, as random firing of neurons in a dying brain. But what happened next cannot be reconciled with our current understanding of brain function. What's fascinating is how this initial phase resembles what some religious traditions describe as purgatory or limbo, a transitional state rather than a final destination. In Catholic theology, purgatory is described as a state of temporary punishment and purification. In Buddhist traditions, the Bardo state represents a similar intermediate realm between death and rebirth. It wasn't heaven or hell, but something in between, a waiting room of consciousness where time had no meaning and identity dissolved into pure awareness. The mechanical, repetitive sounds I heard remind me of patients who've described similar auditory phenomena during partial awareness under anesthesia. Except I wasn't under anesthesia, and my brain wasn't capable of processing sensory information at all. These sounds were like industrial machinery filtered through organic matter, creating a rhythm that seemed both artificial and deeply primitive. Suddenly, something appeared in the darkness, a slowly rotating object radiating fine filaments of white gold light. With it came the most beautiful, complex melody imaginable, growing louder as pure white light descended, obliterating the monotonous mechanical pounding that had been my only companion. At the center of this spinning light appeared an opening. The moment I understood this, I began moving upward rapidly. With a whooshing sound, I passed through and found myself in a completely new world, brilliant, vibrant, and ecstatic. I felt like I was being born. Below stretched a countryside that was earth-like, yet somehow different. Green, lush, and strangely familiar. I flew over trees, fields, streams, and people singing and dancing. This wasn't a dream or hallucination. It was completely real, more real than anything I'd experienced before. Eventually, I realized I wasn't alone. A beautiful girl with deep blue eyes and golden brown hair flew beside me on what appeared to be a butterfly wing, surrounded by millions of butterflies moving like a river of life and color. Without words, she communicated three messages that flooded me with relief. You are loved and cherished dearly forever. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. The message gave me an overwhelming sensation of relief, like finally understanding the rules to a game I'd been playing my entire life. This experience defies conventional neuroscientific explanation. The clarity, complexity, and coherence of these perceptions should be impossible in a brain whose cortex has been disabled by bacterial infection. The visual imagery, emotional content, and conceptual understanding I experienced require higher brain functions that were medically documented as non-functional during my coma. What if our consciousness isn't produced by the brain, but merely filtered through it? Consider how radio waves exist all around us, but we need a receiver to translate them into sound. Perhaps the brain acts as a reducing valve, filtering the vast cosmic consciousness down to a manageable trickle for earthly existence. When that filter is compromised, as mine was through disease, might we access more of that universal consciousness rather than less? Moving deeper into this extraordinary realm, I found myself in a place of enormous pink-white clouds against a deep blue-black sky. Higher still, transparent, shimmering beings arced across the heavens, leaving streamer-like trails. They weren't birds or angels. They were entirely different, more advanced beings than anything I'd known on Earth. A booming, glorious chant descended from above. In this realm, seeing and hearing weren't separate. I could hear the visual beauty and see the perfection of their song. Everything remained distinct yet interconnected, like the intricate patterns of a Persian carpet. Then I entered an immense void, pitch black, yet paradoxically luminous with light from a brilliant living orb. I sensed God's presence so close there seemed no distance between us, yet I could perceive the Creator's infinite vastness. The orb served as an interpreter between me and this extraordinary presence. Through the orb, I learned there are countless universes all centered in love, with evil present only in trace amounts necessary for free will. I witnessed abundant life throughout countless dimensions, some with intelligence far beyond humanity's. Knowledge was imparted directly, stored instantly and permanently, far surpassing anything I'd learned through conventional means during my earthly life. What's remarkable is how similar this experience is to mystical accounts across cultures and throughout history. The Tibetan Book of the Dead describes similar transitions through different planes of existence. Christian mystics like Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross wrote about encounters with divine light beyond description. Islamic Sufi traditions speak of fana, annihilation of the self in divine presence, that parallels my experience in the core. These cross-cultural similarities suggest something profound. Perhaps these experiences aren't merely cultural constructs, but glimpses of a universal reality normally hidden from our everyday perception. The consistency of these accounts across time, geography, and religious background points to something fundamental about consciousness itself. After countless journeys between these realms, something changed. I approached the gateway and found I could no longer enter. The spinning melody would no longer take me there. The gates of heaven were closed. The sadness I felt was unlike any I'd ever known. Emotions are different there, deeper, more spacious, existing both inside and outside simultaneously. I sank through great walls of clouds into increasing sorrow. Countless beings surrounded me, kneeling in arcs stretching into the distance. They were praying for me. Two faces I later identified were Michael Sullivan, our pastor, and his wife Paige. Their prayers gave me energy, and despite my profound sadness, I felt a strange confidence. I was headed into the unknown, but had complete faith I would be taken care of. As I descended, faces bubbled out of the muck, human faces this time, not animal. I could identify six of these faces: my wife Holly, her sister Peggy, my doctor Scott Wade, our friend Sylvia, and Susan Reinches, an intuitive who had attempted to contact me psychically during my coma. One face in particular drew me with special power, the face of my 10-year-old son Bond, pleading for me to return. What's fascinating about this aspect of my experience is the correlation between the faces I saw and the people physically present at my bedside during those final hours before my recovery. This suggests a connection between physical proximity and spiritual awareness that transcends conventional understanding of consciousness. I wasn't consciously aware of who was in my hospital room, yet somehow this information reached me in my non-physical state. This phenomenon of awareness beyond physical capability isn't unique to my case. Hospital studies have documented numerous instances of comatose patients accurately reporting conversations and events that occurred while they were medically unconscious. These cases challenge our understanding of consciousness as solely brain-based and suggest possibilities that mainstream science has yet to fully explore. After 7 days in coma, something remarkable happened. As my son Bond sobbed at my bedside, rubbing my shoulders and saying, "You're going to be okay, Daddy," my eyes suddenly opened. I began looking around like a newborn, taking in the world for the first time. My breathing tube was removed, and I spoke my first words in a week: "Thank you." When my mother and sister arrived, I was sitting up, meeting their gaze. "All is well," I said with a peaceful, joyous smile. "Don't worry, all is well." My return wasn't simple. For days, I experienced what doctors call ICU psychosis, delusions about skydiving, paranoia about internet messages, and hearing grinding, monotonous chants. Despite recognizing family members, I had no memory of my human life before coma, only the earthworm's eye view, gateway, and heavenly core. Gradually, my earthly identity returned. My personality emerged through the fog, my sense of humor, social graces, and even my mischievous streak. Day by day, more of me returned: language, memories, recognition. One neurologist thought I was too euphoric and possibly brain damaged, but I knew something they didn't. I wasn't just well. I was truly well for the first time in my entire life. My medical recovery defies explanation. Bacterial meningitis with the severity I experienced has a mortality rate approaching 100%. The few who survive typically require lifelong care. Yet here I was, not only surviving, but returning to full cognitive function. My doctors were baffled. As one specialist put it, "I've never seen anything like this in my entire career." What makes this case even more extraordinary is that my recovery wasn't gradual. It was sudden and complete. One day, I was in deep coma with no hope of recovery. The next, I was conscious and rapidly improving. This pattern doesn't match how brain recovery typically works. It's as if someone flipped a switch, turning my consciousness back on all at once rather than through the slow, incremental healing we would expect. After my recovery, I was eager to share my experiences, especially with fellow doctors. Their response was predictable. "That's wonderful, Eben. You were very sick. Your brain was soaking in pus. We can't believe you're even here. You know yourself what the brain can come up with when it's that far gone." But as I examined every scientific explanation for my experience, each one fell short. Was it a primitive brainstem program evolved to ease terminal suffering? No, my experiences were far too sophisticated visually, aurally, and conceptually to be products of my reptilian brain. Was it distorted recall of memories from my limbic system? No, without a functioning neocortex, the limbic system couldn't produce visions with such clarity and logic. Could it have been drug-induced? No. All the medications I received work with receptors in the neocortex, which wasn't functioning. The more I studied my condition and consulted scientific literature, the more I came up spectacularly short. Everything, the uncanny clarity of vision, the pure conceptual flow of thought, suggested higher, not lower, brain functioning. Yet my higher brain hadn't been working. What if consciousness isn't produced by the brain at all? What if the brain is more like a receiver than a generator? This idea isn't new. William James proposed it over a century ago, and quantum physics has been pointing in this direction since the 1920s. When Werner Heisenberg and other quantum mechanics pioneers discovered that at the subatomic level, it's impossible to separate the observer from what's being observed, they were revealing something profound about consciousness that science still hasn't fully processed. This doesn't mean abandoning science, quite the opposite. It means expanding science to include consciousness as fundamental rather than incidental to the universe. The hard problem of consciousness, how subjective experience arises from physical processes, remains unsolved precisely because we've been approaching it backward. What if consciousness is primary and physical reality secondary? Despite my conviction about the validity of my experience, one common feature of NDEs troubled me. I hadn't remembered my earthly identity while in the spiritual realm, nor had I met deceased people I'd known in life. Most notably, my father, who had died 4 years before my coma, hadn't appeared to me. As a neurosurgeon who had counseled many grieving families, I had often heard accounts of patients seeing their departed loved ones during near-death experiences. The absence of such familiar faces in my own journey left me questioning. Instead, my companion had been the girl on the butterfly wing, beautiful and angelic, but a complete stranger. She had guided me through the gateway with such profound love and understanding that her presence felt deeply significant, yet mysteriously unfamiliar. This introduced an element of doubt. Not that I questioned what had happened, that was impossible given the vivid reality of my experience, but I wondered why such an important message of love hadn't been delivered by someone I knew, like my father or another deceased relative. Months later, while examining old family photographs in my birth sister Kathy's home, I came across an image that stopped me in my tracks. It was a photograph of my biological sister Betsy, whom I'd never met in life as she had died before I could connect with my birth family. With stunning clarity, I realized she was the beautiful woman who had guided me through the gateway. Without her butterfly wing and heavenly garments, I hadn't immediately recognized her, but now there was no mistaking her loving smile and sparkling blue eyes. The resemblance was unmistakable, the same gentle expression, the same radiant presence that had comforted me in that otherworldly realm. In that moment, my two worlds met. My earthly existence as doctor, father, and husband, and that vast cosmic realm of pure consciousness. This realization healed my fragmented soul, resolving the internal struggle between the doctor committed to science and the experiencer of something profoundly spiritual. The pieces of my journey finally clicked into place, bringing a sense of completion to my understanding of both my adoption story and my spiritual experience. The implications of this recognition are staggering. How could I have recognized someone I'd never met? How could my consciousness have connected with hers when my brain wasn't functioning? These questions point to connections beyond our current scientific understanding, connections that suggest consciousness extends beyond the boundaries of our individual brains and bodies. The fact that I could encounter and later recognize a biological sister I had never known in life challenges our conventional understanding of consciousness, memory, and the nature of human connections. This revelation not only validated my experience, but also suggested that our relationships and bonds transcend physical existence, operating on a level that our current scientific framework struggles to explain. If I had to distill everything I learned during my journey into one word, it would simply be love. Love is, without doubt, the basis of everything. Not abstract love, but the day-to-day kind everyone knows, the love we feel looking at our spouse, children, or animals. In its purest form, this love is unconditional. This is the reality of realities, the glorious truth at the core of everything that exists. No accurate understanding of who we are can be achieved without knowing and embodying this truth. This isn't just the most important emotional truth in the universe, but also the most important scientific truth. The challenge for those who've experienced NDEs isn't reacclimating to earthly limitations, but conveying what this love actually feels like, using mere words to describe something that lies completely beyond language. Deep down, we already know this truth. Just as Dorothy always had the capability to return home, we have the ability to recover our connection with that idyllic realm. We just forget, because our brain blocks out that larger cosmic background, just as sunlight obscures the stars. Our brain's filter, particularly its left-side linguistic/logical part that generates our sense of rationality and ego, is a barrier to our higher knowledge. We're facing a crucial time in our existence. We need to recover more of that larger knowledge while living on Earth, while our brains are fully functioning. Science doesn't contradict what I learned. Too many people believe it does because certain materialist scientists insist spirituality and science cannot coexist. They are mistaken. What if the greatest scientific discovery isn't a new particle or distant galaxy, but the nature of consciousness itself? What if the next frontier isn't outward in space, but inward into the mind? My journey suggests that consciousness is fundamental to reality, not an emergent property of brain activity, but the foundation upon which physical reality itself is built. This perspective doesn't diminish science, it elevates it. It invites us to expand our inquiry beyond the material to include the experiential. it suggests that the most sophisticated instrument for studying consciousness isn't an MRI machine or EEG, but consciousness itself. Perhaps the ancient wisdom traditions weren't primitive superstitions, but sophisticated methodologies for exploring consciousness from the inside, complementary to our external scientific approach. The unconditional love I experienced is the single most important discovery I will ever make. Sharing this simple message, one that most children readily accept, is my most important task. Not because I'm special, but because my case breaks the back of materialist science's claim that consciousness isn't the central mystery of existence. It is. And solving that mystery could transform not just science, but our entire understanding of what it means to be human.